The men reached the river at dusk. They reined their horses to a stop on a sandstone bluff overlooking the twisting course of the river. The western sky was a garish red from the sun that had set a short time earlier, and the water reflected that color so that the Rio Bravo looked like a river of blood as it meandered its way on down toward the Gulf of Mexico. As Hector Galindo sat on his horse and gazed across at Texas in the fading light, he felt excitement stirring within him. Soon, and for the first time in his life, he would be leaving his native Mexico. That was something to look forward to, even though it would be dangerous. A week ago, he had been nothing but a simple farmer. Now, he was a revolutionary. And that was very exciting, too. For several days, the group had ridden northward with Diego Alcazario and Florio Cruz at its head. Alcazario had visited several other villages besides the one where Hector lived, and at each place he had recruited more men for his band of freedom fighters, promising the young men who joined him that they would help him strike a mortal blow against the wicked dictator Diaz. Hector believed him. He knew that some people considered Alcazario's men to be nothing more than bandits, but Hector knew that wasn't true. They served a noble cause. Of course, it was a bit puzzling that they were going north when El Presidente Diaz was in Mexico City far to the south, but Hector didn't trouble himself over that. He knew that their leader had to have a brilliant plan, and sooner or later, Alcazario would explain it. Until then, Hector was content to follow orders. Alcazario turned his horse around so that he could face his men as he addressed them.
We will make camp here. No fires. Even though the closest settlement on the Texas side of the river is 5 miles away, we do not want any gringos discovering that we are here.
That made sense to Hector. The gringos were evil. Everyone knew that. Perhaps not quite as evil as El Presidente, who oppressed his own people, but still, it was best for Alcazario's men not to announce their presence this close to the border, Hector thought. Following Alcazario's orders, the men pulled back a little so that their camp was located at the base of the bluff away from the river, where they would not be easily spotted. Grass was sparse, but enough for the horses. As night settled down, the men made a meager meal of tortillas and beans. Hector hunkered on his heels and began to munch on a tortilla, but he had barely started eating when a lean shadow fell over him. Hector looked up and saw Florio Cruz standing there.
Diego wants to meet with you.
Hector realized he was gaping. He snapped his mouth shut and scrambled to his feet.
Of course, Senor Cruz. It will be my great pleasure. More than a pleasure. An honor, a great honor.
Cruz's curt gesture told Hector to be silent and follow. He did so, and Cruz led him to an outcropping of rock where Diego Alcazario sat cross-legged on the ground with his back against the stone. He had a bottle in his hand.
Here is the man you requested.
Alcazario looked up at Hector.
You're Galindo?
Si, General.
Sit. Have a drink with me.
Hector sat down on the ground, and his hand shook a little as he reached for the bottle. He took the bottle, tipped it to his mouth, and tried not to gag on the fiery tequila that burned its way down his throat. Alcazario took the bottle back and did not offer again, but that didn't matter. Hector had had a drink with the great revolutionary leader. He would never forget this moment.
I have asked around about you, Galindo. I am told that you speak the gringo's tongue.
Si, General. When I was a boy, I helped a priest in our village. He was a gringo and he taught me to speak English.
Why would a gringo be allowed in your village?
I do not know for sure, Senor Cruz. But he was a man with great sadness in him, and a fondness for the pulque made by the old men in the village. I believe he had some dark secret in his past, and wished to get as far away from it as he could.
A sad, drunken priest. One of many such in the world, eh? What is important is that he taught you to speak the tongue of the hated gringos. Do you still understand it, Galindo?
Si, General. Though I have not spoken the words much since I was a child, I still understand them when I hear them. With practice, I am sure I would understand even better.
You'll get your practice. You're going across the river.
Into Texas, General?
That's right. To the settlement called Sweet Apple. There you will watch and listen, pretending to be nothing more than a simple Mexican peasant. There are things I need to know, and you will find them out for me, Galindo. Then you will return here and tell me these things.
Of course, General, but how will I know what I need to find out?
I will tell you. Lean closer, boy. Consider yourself fortunate. Tonight, you will be made privy to the plans of the great Diego Alcazario. Tonight, you will learn of the vengeance that will soon strike at the very hearts of those damned Texans.
The night passed quietly in Sweet Apple, without even a fight in the Black Bull or one of the other saloons for Matt and Sam to break up. After spending the night in the marshal's office, they went to the hotel the next morning to check on Seymour. He opened the door of his room with a gun in his hand, even though Sam had called through the panel after knocking on it to let him know who they were.
Now you're getting smart. Always figure that somebody's out to kill you and you're liable to live longer.
I'm not sure that's a fit way for a man to live.
Maybe not. But you chose it when you buckled on that gun belt and pinned that badge on your vest.
I'm afraid you're right.
Any problems last night?
None whatsoever.
How was that soup Miss O'Ryan fixed for you?
It was excellent. Very soothing for the throat.
And I'll bet the company wasn't bad either.
It was a very pleasant evening. But don't try to make anything out of that. Absolutely nothing improper happened.
I'm sure it didn't. We took a look around that barn where those fellows jumped you.
Did you find anything that told you who they were?
Not really. The rope they used could have come from anywhere. The only unusual thing was that their footprints looked like they were wearing shoes instead of boots.
That's a bit unusual for these parts, isn't it?
Well, no. A lot of folks here in town wear shoes instead of boots. All it really tells us is that the men who tried to kill you probably aren't cowboys, or anybody else who rides a horse on a regular basis.
I suppose that eliminates some of the suspects, at least.
Yeah. In fact, I was thinking...
What in the world?
Seymour swung around toward the window. He hurried over to it, followed by Matt and Sam, and looked out to see what all the ruckus was about. Down in the street, the gunfighter named Cole Halliday had confronted a stocky young Mexican leading a burro. It was obvious that Halliday had shot the straw sombrero right off the Mexican's head. The sombrero, now with a couple of bullet holes in its tall crown, lay in the street, and every time its owner reached for it, Halliday fired again, knocking the sombrero just out of the Mexican's reach.
Blast it! That's just about what Cole did to me. I thought he'd gotten over such childish antics.
Seymour swung around and headed for the door in a hurry, obviously intending to put a stop to Halliday's fun. Matt and Sam went after him. Even though they hadn't been in Sweet Apple when it happened, they had heard all about how Cole Halliday had shot up Seymour's derby the day Seymour first arrived. The story had already become part of the town's lore and legends, despite the fact that it had happened less than 2 months earlier. Quite a crowd had gathered to watch Halliday humiliate the farmer. Some of them were laughing along with the gunslinger, while others frowned in disapproval. The shot sent the bullet-riddled sombrero flying into the air for a few feet. Its owner stumbled after it. Seymour pushed through the crowd and stepped out into the open area in the middle of the street.
Cole Halliday, stop that right now.
Hell, Marshal, you should not have done a thing like that. I was getting ready to ventilate that greaser's hat again. I might have hit you by accident.
There'll be no more shooting at this poor man's hat or anything else.
Standish reached down, picked up the sombrero, and extended it toward the Mexican, who shuffled forward and accepted it with a grateful nod.
In fact, if you don't holster that gun immediately, I'm going to confiscate it and place you under arrest for disturbing the peace.
What the hell are you talking about? You're going to take my gun and throw me in jail? I don't think so, Marshal.
That's what's going to happen if you don't do as I say.
Matt and Sam had stopped on the hotel porch. They leaned against the posts that held up the second-floor balcony, their casual poses belying the fact that both of them were ready to go into action in less than a heartbeat if needed. Halliday glared at Seymour.
I'd have thought you had more sense than that, Marshal. I've been trying to steer clear of you, but I'll be damned if that means I'm going to let you buffalo me.
All I'm asking you to do is to cease tormenting this man and go on about your business. Whether you make it more than that is up to you.
I see now why you're so brave this morning, Seymour. You got your two pet gunfighters with you.
We're nobody's pets, Halliday. And Seymour called the turn. This is his dance, not ours.
You're saying that you'll stay out of it if the Marshal and I throw down on each other?
That's what we're saying.
Folks in the street began to scatter as it started to look more and more like lead would be flying soon.
You know that if I draw on Seymour, I'll kill him. And he's not Seymour the Lily-livered anymore, so he doesn't have that to protect him.
Maybe you will kill him. But it could be that Seymour is better with a gun than you give him credit for, Halliday. Sam and I have been helping him practice. I've got a $20 gold piece right here that says he gets some lead in you, no matter what you do.
Damn it, I don't want a gun down a lawman. Then every other star packer in these parts will be after me. I'm not scared of him, but it'd be a damn nuisance.
Then holster your gun and walk away. It's that simple. Anyway, Cole, I know you're not really a cruel man. We fought side by side when those outlaws attacked the town. Just don't fall back into your old habit of making trouble.
Aw, damn it! You're trying to civilize me! Sweet Apple used to be the most hell-roaring place in the border country. Now look at it now! It's getting positively tame since you came to town, Seymour.
Thank you. That's quite a compliment.
I don't mean it as a damn compliment!
Halliday suddenly jammed his revolver back in its holster.
There! You satisfied, Marshal?
Indeed I am. Thank you.
You ain't welcome!
Still fuming, Halliday turned and stalked toward the Black Bull, obviously intent on guzzling down some whiskey despite the relatively early hour. Seymour waited until Halliday had slapped aside the bat wings and vanished into the saloon before he turned and walked back to where Matt and Sam waited on the hotel porch. His face was pale, but composed.
Well, that was a near thing.
If you mean Halliday came close to blowing a hole through you, you're right about that.
Would you have let him do it?
We'll be riding on one of these days, probably before too much longer. It's going to be up to you to keep the peace, Seymour. You have to be able to handle the job.
That doesn't really answer my question.
What I said was true. I think there's a good chance you'd have got lead in him. Halliday knew that, too. That's why I turned and walked away. You pushed him just far enough, Seymour, but not too far. He knows you're the law now, and he knows you mean business. I reckon even an hombre like Halliday can respect that.
I hope so. And I hope Sweet Apple does become civilized.
He'll be long gone before that ever happens.
Seymour felt a tug on his sleeve and turned to see the stocky young Mexican standing there, his ventilated sombrero in his hands. The young man had a round face and a mustache that drooped over both ends of his mouth.
Oh, gracias, senor. I appreciate your help.
That's quite all right. It's my job to see that no one is mistreated in Sweet Apple. I don't recall seeing you in town before.
I have not been here in a long time. I have a farm down by the border, by the Rio Bravo. I came to buy supplies.
Well, I hope this unfortunate incident won't keep you from coming to town more often in the future, Señor...
Galindo. My nombre is Hector Galindo. And thanks to you, Marshal, I will be able to stay in Sweet Apple until I have everything that I need.
I thought that gunman was about to take care of my problem for me. Then, not only would I be rid of Seymour and any possible interference with my plans, but I wouldn't have to pay that bonus I promised to those so-called professional killers either.
Rebecca Jimerson knew that Standish had been watching a showdown of some sort in the street between Seymour and one of the local gunslingers.
Bonus?
That's right. I told Welsh, McCracken, and Stover that in addition to the fees we already agreed on, I'd pay a $3,000 bonus to whichever one of them actually kills Seymour.
You really want him dead, don't you?
I thought you knew that already. Why else do you think I came out here to this godforsaken wilderness?
Oh, I knew. I just didn't know how far you were willing to go.
As far as it takes.
Rebecca nodded, realizing that the same thing was true of her. She had thought that Seymour himself might represent a way out for her. That's why she had revealed her feelings to him. And then he had rejected her. All because he was in love with that dough-faced little half-breed schoolteacher. The memory was still like a knife in Rebecca's guts. Well, Seymour didn't know it, but he still might represent a way for her to get away from Cornelia Standish for good. $3,000 would take her a long way. With that much money, she could start a whole new life for herself. Rebecca turned her back to Standish and smiled at the thought. She didn't lose the smile even when he slid the silk off her shoulders and began caressing her. Her mind was somewhere else, and she barely felt his touch. Hector led the burro toward the general store, aware that Marshal Standish and the two gringo gunfighters, Bodine and Two Wolves, were watching him. General Alcazario had explained who those men were and why he hated them so. If the general hated them, then so did Hector. But it was more difficult to do so than he had expected because of the way the marshal had risked his own life to intervene when that other gunfighter decided to humiliate a poor Mexican farmer. Bodine and Two Wolves had stood ready to take his part, too, if they needed to. Hector forced any thoughts of sympathy and gratitude out of his mind. Alcazario had sent him to Sweet Apple to carry out an important mission, and he intended to do exactly that, no matter what it required. He certainly hadn't hesitated early this morning when he stole the burro from an old man's farm just north of the Rio. If he was going to pretend to still be a farmer himself, it would look better if he had a burro. So he had taken one from the first place he came to. Unfortunately, the animal's owner had seen Hector leading it out of the barn and had run out of the house, screeching furiously and waving around an equally ancient shotgun that probably wouldn't even fire. Hector hadn't waited to find out if the old scattergun worked. He had used the rifle that Alcazario had so kindly provided for him and blown the old man's brains out. Then, leading the burro, he'd resumed his journey to Sweet Apple. Outside of the settlement, he had found an arroyo and changed out of the new clothes the general had given him, putting on the white shirt and trousers and the sandals he had been wearing when he left his village to join the revolutionaries. He cached the better clothing there, along with the rifle and his horse. Now, he was armed only with a knife, which was not an uncommon weapon for a farmer to carry. It would arouse no suspicion. Hector went into the general store and pretended to look around. In reality, he was listening to the conversations going on among the townspeople around him. The best places to pick up useful information were stores such as this one and saloons like the Black Bull, which Hector had noticed across the street. Diego Alcazario both spoke and read English. Even in hiding in the mountains of Mexico, he was able to obtain gringo newspapers from Marfa, El Paso, and San Antonio. In them, he had read accounts of the battle at Sweet Apple, when the American army and the citizens of the town had prevented him from obtaining the new rifles he desired so badly. That was how he had learned of Sweet Apple's marshal, Seymour Standish, and the two gunmen, Bodine and Two Wolves. The one called Two Wolves was half gringo, half Indian, but that didn't matter to Alcazario. Half gringo was the same as all gringo as far as he was concerned, and worthy of just as much hatred as any other gringo. The general had explained all of this to Hector in the group's camp below the border. Alcazario had explained as well about the ranchers named Colton and Paxton.
They're the two richest men this side of El Paso. And each man has a beautiful young daughter. Eh? Eh? You know what I mean, Galindo?
Si, General.
Those gringos will pay handsomely to ensure the safe return of their daughters. $100,000 for each.
What can I do to help, General?
So Alcazario had explained how he, Hector, would go to Sweet Apple and pretend to be nothing more than a peasant. A sort of poor farmer who was as plentiful as fleas in the border country. Once there, he would find out everything he could about the ranchers Colton and Paxton and their families. What Alcazario really wanted to do was to raid Sweet Apple again, this time while both girls were there. It would be too difficult to steal them from their father's ranches, he had explained, but an attack on the town would create much confusion. And in that chaos, it would be easier to snatch the young women and get away with them.
So you see, my young amigo, much depends on you. You will determine when we strike. When you see Jessica Colton and Sandra Paxton together in Sweet Apple, you will ride here and tell us the time has come for the attack. Can you do this thing?
Si, General. I will do this just as you say.
And now, As he stood in the general store in Sweetapple, he was no less determined to carry out his mission than he had been when he arrived in the settlement. The fact that the marshal had taken his part against the gunslinger's cruelties meant nothing. Hector knew the Colton and Paxton women would never live through the kidnapping. When Alcazario's men were through with them, they would be fit for nothing except the coyotes and the buzzards. It was a harsh destiny indeed. But that did not matter, Hector told himself, not for the first time. All that mattered was the Revolucion. Since the deaths of the two cowboys named Rusty and Bill, Shad Colton hadn't tried to keep Esau Paxton's cows from drinking at the creek between their ranches. The judge had promised a speedy hearing and a decision on the case within a week or two. Colton had decided that he could tolerate Pax's cows drinking his water for that long. Because of that, when his lawyer, Colonel Hugh Addison, drove up to the Double C Ranch House in a fine buggy pulled by a pair of magnificent horses, Colton assumed the lawyer was there to tell him that Judge Wilbur had set a date for announcing his decision in the case. Colton stepped out onto the porch and stuck his hands in his hip pockets of his jeans.
Howdy, Hugh. What brings you out here?
The rotund, ruddy-faced lawyer climbed down from the buggy.
Yeah, got some news. I'd rather come up there on the porch and sit in the shade to tell you about it, though.
Sure, come on. I tell my missus to bring us some lemonade.
Yeah, that sounds mighty fine.
Addison climbed to the porch. They didn't talk business until they were both settled down in cane-bottom chairs with sweating glasses of lemonade in hand.
So, what's this news you mentioned? Judge Wilbur ready to announce his decision, is he?
Judge Wilbur's not going to be announcing any decision. He's recused himself from the case.
What in blazes does that mean?
Means he's taken himself off the case. A judge usually does that when he's got some sort of conflict of interest, like one of the parties is his brother-in-law or something. But this was for health reasons. The judge got knocked down by a runaway horse a few days ago. Broke his right leg and a couple of ribs.
That shouldn't mean he can't decide one way or the other in a case between me and Paxton.
Well, that's up to the judge. And he didn't think he was in good enough shape to render a fair and proper verdict.
Well, what are we supposed to do then? Wait till he's better and start the whole damn thing over?
No. There's a federal circuit judge due through these parts in a couple of days. And Judge Wilbur has transferred jurisdiction of the case to him.
A federal judge? Can he do that?
Well, since the case involves water rights, he can. Wilbur and this new judge have already been in touch by telegram, and Judge Clark agreed to take on the case. Only hitch is that he wants to have a new hearing so he can get the facts straight.
You mean we've got to go to Marfa and do it all over again?
No. Since Judge Clark is used to traveling around, being a circuit judge and all, he's agreed to hold the hearing in Sweetapple. Day after tomorrow, in fact.
Can you be ready for a hearing that soon?
Sure. The facts haven't changed since last time. All I gotta do is present them again. And the law's still on your side, Shad. I'm sure of that.
Well, then, I reckon there's nothing else we can do but go along with this new judge.
Well, that's exactly what I'm advising you to do as your attorney. The hearing will be at 10 o'clock in the morning, day after tomorrow in the town hall.
I'll be there. Maybe this blasted mess will get settled once and for all.
Since the talkative Colonel Addison had stopped in Sweetapple on his way to the Double C and had a drink at the Black Bull, news of the developments in the legal case was already going around town. Gossip was one of the chief pastimes in any frontier settlement, and Sweetapple was no different. Matt and Sam heard about it while they were at the livery stable with Seymour, who had decided that he needed a horse.
Mayor Mitchell and Mr. Heathcote say that the town will provide a mount for me as long as the cost is reasonable. Though I'm afraid I don't have much experience with horses. I thought maybe the two of you could go with me to the stable and...
Sure, Seymour. We've been sticking to you like a burr anyway. Might as well go to the stable as anywhere else.
How about that one?
Seymour pointed to a bay gelding inside the corral. The proprietor of the stable, a man named Huddleston, had followed them out to the fence.
Well, you got a good eye for the horse flesh, Marshal. It's one of my finest animals. I can let you have him for only $150.
Seymour looked over at Matt and Sam, both of whom shook their heads.
That horse is too fine-boned, Seymour. Might have pretty good speed starting out, but no sand.
That's the horse you want.
Sam pointed to an ugly, hammer-headed, mouse-colored animal with a dark stripe down its back.
Really? He doesn't look like much. Not that I'd really know.
I don't know, Marshal. I reckon that Dunn's strong enough, but he's mean. He'll take a bite out of your hide if you don't watch him close.
Could be that's right, but he'll run all day for you. And that deep chest says he's got as much speed as you'll ever need.
You can tell that just by looking at him?
You wanted our opinion.
Certainly, and I have no reason to doubt that you're right.
Seymour turned to Huddleston.
How much for that horse?
Yeah. $50, and I'll feel like I'm cheating you at that, Marshal.
Take it.
You have a deal, my good man.
The two men were shaking hands when J. Emerson Heathcote came walking up.
Have you heard about the hearing?
What hearing?
Well, I suppose I shouldn't be spreading the news verbally. I should make everyone wait to read it in the Sweet Apple Gazette, but the rumors are going around. A new judge has been appointed to settle the dispute between Shad Colton and Esau Paxton, and he's going to hold a hearing right here in Sweet Apple day after tomorrow. It'll be the biggest legal case we've ever had adjudicated here.
I reckon Colton and Paxton will be coming into town for that hearing?
Oh, of course. I'll have to be on hand to testify.
That means you're going to have your hands full, Seymour.
Why? I don't have anything to do with that court case.
Chances are that Colton and Paxton will bring their families and most of their crews with them. That means Sweet Apple will be full of proddy cowboys with a grudge against each other.
And it'll be up to you to keep the peace.
Oh, yes. I suppose it will. Can I count on your help?
Sure. We'll be around for that long. We may be getting a little restless, but we're not in that much of a hurry to leave.
I'm glad to hear it.
Seymour turned back to Huddleston.
Now, I suppose I'll need a saddle, too.
When they had concluded the deal, they agreed that Seymour would keep his horse and tack at the stable for a nominal monthly fee.
I'll speak to the mayor and the rest of the town council about paying for that expense, too, Marshal.
I'd be much obliged, Mr. Heathcote.
You're starting to sound like you belong out here, Seymour. Next thing you know, you'll be saying that it's fixing to rain or something like that.
The four men headed back toward the marshal's office, with Seymour and Heathcote walking together in front and talking. Matt and Sam trailed along a short distance behind. Their eyes roved constantly over both sides of the street, searching for any sign of danger. Even though nothing had happened for a couple of days, neither of the Blood Brothers believed that the threat was over. Whoever wanted Seymour dead was bound to try again sooner or later.
Isn't that the fella Cole Holiday was hurrahing the other day?
Matt looked and saw a stocky Mexican leaving the cantina. The young man's face was familiar, but even if it hadn't been, the bullet holes in the crown of his sombrero would have identified him.
Yeah, that's him all right. I thought he said he came to Sweet Apple to buy some supplies.
Shouldn't he have headed back to his farm by now?
You'd think so.
The Mexican, Hector, that was his name, Matt recalled, stumbled a little as he went over to untie his burro from a nearby hitch rail. Matt smiled as Hector started to lead the burro out of town.
I reckon that explains it. I don't see any supplies loaded on his donkey. He must have spent the past couple of days blowing his money on tequila.
That's too bad. He's liable to have a hard time of it now, until he can scrape up some more dinero.
That's his lookout, not ours. Come on, Seymour's getting too far ahead of us.
The Blood Brothers stepped up their pace, not looking back at the raggedly clothed Mexican who was plodding southward out of Sweet Apple, leading the little burro. It had taken a couple of days of hanging around the settlement, but things could not have worked out much better, Hector Galindo thought, as he left Sweet Apple behind. The developments he had heard about today would play right into the hands of Diego Alcazario. The Coltons and Paxtons would all be in town for the court hearing, including Jessica Colton and Sandra Paxton. And they would be in one place, making it easier for Alcazario to abduct them. The only drawback was that many of the cowboys from the Double C and Pax ranches would probably be on hand for the hearing too, which meant there could be more opposition to the general's plans than there might have been otherwise. But Alcazario would never get a better chance to kidnap the two girls, Hector thought. And the way things had turned out, the general would even have time to plan his raid, since it wouldn't take place until the day after tomorrow. Each of the past two nights, Hector had checked on the horse he'd left hidden outside of town, making sure the animal had enough water and grass. This time, when he reached the arroyo, he changed back into his new clothes, saddled the horse, and rode south, a revolutionary again instead of the poor farmer he had pretended to be for the past 2 days. He took the burrow with him, not wanting to release it so close to the settlement. He didn't want anyone to come across the animal and wonder what had happened to him. Everyone needed to think he had simply returned to his farm. Later that day, Hector reached the Rio Grande and crossed it, leaving the burrow to fend for itself. As he rode up the bluff, he felt eyes watching him and knew that the lookouts posted by Alcazario had spotted him. They had probably already sent word to the general that he was coming. That proved to be true when Hector reached the camp and found it in a state of suppressed excitement. The men all knew that his return meant something important was about to happen. Knowing that made a good feeling swell up inside Hector. He was important to Alcazario's plans. He had been entrusted with a vital mission, and he had not failed the general. Alcazario and Florio Cruz strode out to meet Hector as he dismounted.
What have you found out?
The two señoritas will be in Sweet Apple at 10 o'clock in the morning, 2 days hence.
Hector went on to explain about the legal dispute between Shadrach Colton and Esau Paxton and the hearing that would be held at the town hall.
You have done a fine job, amigo.
Cruz didn't look happy, though.
There are going to be a lot of men in the town, and they will be well armed.
Of course they will, but they will be no match for us. Also, we will take them by surprise. Their wariness will be directed toward each other, not toward any threat from outside.
Are you sure, Diego?
Of course I am. Come. We will talk about it and decide exactly how we will attack the gringos. And it must be made clear to all the men that no harm shall come to the two señoritas. That is most important.
What about Bodine and two wolves?
Oh, they will die. I wish I could kill them myself. Perhaps I will. But all that really matters is that they not be left alive.
Seymour was confused. The three men his uncle had brought to Sweet Apple to develop the sales territory here in West Texas for the Standish Dry Goods Company never seemed to do any actual work. They weren't calling on merchants in Sweet Apple. They weren't visiting any other settlements in the area. In short, they didn't seem to be interested in selling dry goods at all. At first, Seymour told himself that was none of his business. But of course it was, because he still owned a half interest in the company. He knew his father would never have allowed such laggard behavior from employees. Seymour was surprised that his uncle tolerated it. Cornelius had always been the more impatient and demanding of the brothers. So, he owed it to his father's memory, Seymour decided, to talk with his uncle and see if he could find out what was going on. He reached that decision on the morning when the hearing on the dispute between Shad Colton and Esau Paxton was scheduled to take place. Seymour knew he would have to be there for the hearing to keep the peace in case any trouble broke out between the two factions, but he thought he would have time to talk to Cornelius before that. Seymour put his hat on and left the office, checking up and down the street first just to make sure that no one was lurking out there, waiting to take a shot at him. Matt and Sam seemed convinced there would be another attempt on his life, but Seymour wasn't sure about that. The would-be killers, whoever they were, could have decided that getting rid of him was too much trouble and moved on instead. As he walked toward the hotel, Seymour spotted a familiar figure coming from the opposite direction and felt pleasure and surprise go through him. He met Maggie O'Ryan on the porch in front of the hotel.
Why aren't you down at the school today?
School is out, Seymour. Didn't you know? I would have thought that the way the children were whooping so happily yesterday afternoon when I dismissed them for the last time would have told you.
I'm sorry. I'm afraid I didn't notice. I knew that you'd been very busy the past few days.
Getting everything finished up for the year.
Perhaps now we can spend more time together.
I'd like that. Until school starts again in the fall, anyway.
I was wondering if perhaps you'd like to take a buggy ride with me sometime.
That sounds wonderful. I could pack a picnic lunch for us.
Wonderful indeed. We'll talk about it later and decide where and when. Right now, I'm sorry, but I have to tend to some business.
I understand. You'll be at the hearing later?
Oh, of course.
I'll see you there.
Maggie came up on her toes and brushed her lips across his in a kiss. To do such a thing in broad daylight on a public street was pretty brazen. But Seymour liked it. His heart was pounding hard as he left Maggie and went into the hotel. More than ever, he thought that perhaps he had found the woman with whom he wanted to spend the rest of his life. He stopped short as he saw Rebecca Jimerson standing in the lobby, her arms crossed and an icy look on her face. Seymour glanced over his shoulder and realized that if Rebecca had been standing where she was a moment earlier, she had probably been able to watch through the hotel's front window as Maggie kissed him.
Miss Jimerson, Rebecca, how are you today?
I'm fine. I don't suppose I need to ask how you are, Seymour. I could see that perfectly well for myself just now.
I'm looking for my uncle. Have you seen Cornelius this morning?
I certainly have. He's upstairs in his room with those so-called salesmen of his.
So-called? What do you mean by that, Rebecca?
I don't know. It's just that they don't seem to be very interested in selling dry goods, do they? They hang around here at the hotel and at that saloon called the Black Bull, and as far as I can see, they haven't done a lick of work since they came to Sweet Apple.
This is incredible. I was about to go talk to Uncle Cornelius about the very same thing. I didn't know that you were worried about it, too.
You can't talk to him right now. Those men are in with him discussing God knows what.
Rebecca put a hand on Seymour's arm.
Come up to my room with me. It's right across the hall from Mr. Standish's room. We'll be able to hear them when they leave, and then you can go talk to him.
All right.
Come along, then. It'll be nice to visit while we're waiting for those men to leave.
As they started up the stairs, Seymour felt a momentary surge of uneasiness. He was going to be alone with Rebecca in her hotel room for an undetermined amount of time. Given what had happened on the last occasion when they were together like that, this might not be such a good idea after all. Of course, he knew that nothing improper would happen because he wouldn't allow it to. But if Maggie heard about it... There was no reason for her to hear anything of the sort, he told himself. Anyway, there was nothing going on between him and Rebecca. This was strictly business. Still, he was glad the lobby and the second-floor corridor were deserted at the moment, so that there was no one to see him going into Rebecca Jimerson's room. No one to see the door closing behind them.
What the hell?
Matt came into the marshal's office carrying one of the breakfast trays. Sam was right behind him with the two other trays, one in each hand.
What's wrong?
Seymour's not here.
They set the trays on the desk and took a quick look around. But there weren't that many places to hide in the small office, and no reason for Seymour to be hiding in the first place.
He might have gone back to the privy.
You take a look out there while I check up and down the street and see if I can spot him.
Sam nodded and went out the office's rear door. Matt left by the front and stopped on the boardwalk to peer both directions along the street, searching for Seymour. He hadn't found the marshal by the time Sam came back through the office and reported a similar lack of results.
He's not in the privy. Where could he have gotten off to?
I reckon he could have gone over to the hotel to see his uncle. Don't know why he would have when he knew we were expecting him to stay here. But he's Seymour. Can't always tell what he's going to do.
Breakfast was forgotten as the Blood Brothers started down the street toward the hotel. In all likelihood, there was an innocent explanation for Seymour's absence, and he wasn't in any real danger, but Matt and Sam couldn't forget the two previous attempts on his life. The sound of hoofbeats, a lot of hoofbeats, distracted Matt and Sam before they reached the hotel. They stopped and swung around to see a buckboard and more than 20 riders entering the settlement. A big, red-headed man on horseback led the procession. Matt and Sam recognized Shad Colton. The rancher had arrived early for the hearing, bringing his family and what looked like most of his crew with him.
I figured practically the whole Double C bunch would show up. Didn't think they'd get here quite this soon, though.
That's not the problem. They're not the only ones riding in early.
Matt saw the dust rising into the clear morning sky just outside the settlement. A group of roughly the same size was coming into town, and it could only be Esau Paxton and his family and riders.
Damn it. We need to keep those two bunches apart, or there may be trouble before the hearing ever gets started.
Yeah. Let's hope Seymour is all right, because we don't have time to go looking for him now.
He'll show up.
Matt and Sam strode quickly down the street. The Colton party had come to a halt in front of the town's meeting hall. Carolyn Colton and Jesse were on the buckboard, with Carolyn handling the reins. Both women wore dresses and sunbonnets. Matt thought that Jesse looked like she would have preferred wearing boots and jeans and a Stetson and making the trip on horseback like her father. but he supposed she was trying to look like a lady since the family was going to court. Sam walked quickly along the street to intercept the Paxton party. Matt lifted a hand in greeting as Shad Colton swung down from the saddle.
Morning, Mr. Colton. You're here might early.
Didn't want Paxton trying to steal a march on me. I don't know this new judge. Paxton might try to make friends with him, or even bribe him.
I don't think that's going to happen. We met Judge Clark yesterday evening, and he strikes me as the sort of hombre who's going to be fair, come hell or high water.
We'll see about that.
Colton turned to the buggy to help his wife down from the vehicle. Jesse didn't wait for anybody to help her, although Matt would have if she'd given him the chance. She stepped down from the buggy on her own as Matt went over to her.
I hope you and Sam plan on going to the hearing. The boys are a mite proddy this morning.
Don't worry. We'll be there to make sure that things don't get out of hand.
Where's the marshal?
Matt shrugged. He wished he could answer that question. The double C punchers started for the double doors that opened into the town hall. Before they got there, the doors swung open and a formidable figure barred the way. Judge Simon Clark stood there in a dusty black suit with a shotgun tucked under his right arm.
Gentlemen, for the duration of the hearing this morning, this town hall is now a federal courtroom. And as such, no guns are allowed amongst the spectators. You'll all be required to turn in your firearms if you want to attend the hearing.
Shad Colton pointed at Matt.
What about Bodine and Two Wolves?
I'm hereby appointing them Deputy United States Marshals.
Hold on a minute, Judge.
These appointments are temporary for the duration of this case or until I otherwise rescind them, but they are legal and binding. Therefore, Mr. Bodine and Mr. Two Wolves have full authority to enforce my orders. And my first such order is that they collect the guns from anybody who wants to come into my courtroom.
Does the same thing go for Paxton and his bunch?
You're damn right it does.
Sort of a high-handed hombre, aren't you?
I'm a federal circuit court judge, and before I took up the law, I carried this very same greener as a shotgun guard for a stagecoach line. So, yeah, I reckon you could say that I'm used to getting my way.
All right, boys. You heard what the judge said. Chuck them shooting irons as you go in.
Matt heaved a mental sigh of relief as Colton handed over his revolver and then took his wife's arm to lead her into the town hall. Jesse followed them. Matt supposed that the younger Colton children had remained on the ranch with the cook and the skeleton crew that had been left behind. The double C hands filed in. Matt took their guns as they went by. He wasn't prepared for such a chore and didn't have any place to put them, so he wound up with his arms full of revolvers. He was grateful when Abner Mitchell came up with a bushel basket from the general store.
I saw your dilemma, Matt. Put the guns in here. I'll bring another basket for Sam to use when he disarms Paxton's group. Disarming those cowboys go a long way toward keeping the peace, won't it?
Can't hurt.
Sam had held the Paxton bunch down the street until everyone from the double C had gone inside. Esau Paxton didn't look happy about it when Sam finally allowed them to ride on to the town hall. His wife, Julia, and daughter, Sandy, were in a buggy, as Carolyn and Jesse Colton had been. But the twins, 16-year-old Royce and Dave, were on horseback like their father and the rest of the men. They were packing guns like the rest of the men, too. Matt quickly filled Sam in on Judge Clark's edict about no guns in the courtroom other than theirs, and that old greener, Matt supposed. Sam nodded and turned to Paxton.
You heard the rules, sir. You and your men will have to turn in your guns before you can go inside.
And put ourselves at the mercy of that renegade Colton and his pack of thieves? I don't think so.
Mr. Colton and his men gave up their guns. This hearing's going to be nice and peaceful.
I suppose you don't have to attend. Your lawyer can represent you.
If Colton's in there, I'm going to be in there. Here. Here's my damned gun.
Paxton didn't say anything else as he took Julia's arm to escort her into the town hall. The Pax riders followed the same course as the double C men had, filing into the building and surrendering their guns as they did so. When everybody was inside, Matt and Sam left the baskets containing the weapons on the boardwalk in front of the town hall. Nobody would bother them. The Blood Brothers stepped through the open doors and saw that the hall was crowded. Colton's bunch had congregated on the right side of the room, while Paxton and his family and riders had gone to the left. They had scooted their chairs away from each other so that an aisle that hadn't been there earlier had been formed. At the front of the room, Judge Simon Clark sat behind a table on which lay the shotgun and a gavel, as well as a Bible, some blank sheets of paper, and an inkwell and pen. At one end of the table was an empty chair, for witnesses, Matt supposed. Clark let the hubbub continue for a while, then pulled a pocket watch from his vest and opened it.
Lawyers for both parties aren't here yet, or I'd go ahead and get started. Keep the racket down. Court's not in session yet, but I'll still have some decorum in my courtroom.
Matt and Sam took up positions to either side of the doors and waited. A few minutes later, Colonel Hugh Addison, Colton's lawyer, arrived. He was followed a few minutes after that by Everett Sloan, Paxton's attorney. The room was already so crowded that there was no room for more spectators, but J. Emerson Heathcote slipped in, nodded to Matt and Sam, and stood along the back wall, pencil and pad in hand, ready to take notes for his newspaper story. The two lawyers conferred briefly with the judge, then went to chairs in the front of the room. They didn't sit down, though, because Clark reached for his gavel.
All rise.
Matt looked over at Sam.
Sure as hell wish I knew where Seymour was.
This court is now in session.
Rebecca told herself to ignore the pounding in her chest. This was one time she had to listen to her head and not her heart. $3,000 was a fortune to her, and it could change her entire life.
Don't be so nervous, Seymour. Believe it or not, you're not doing anything wrong.
I know. I just hope that it won't be long before those men leave Uncle Cornelius's room. I'm anxious to talk to him, that's all.
Oh, I thought you were worried about being alone with me in my hotel room.
Not at all. We're friends. Nothing wrong with friends being together, right?
That's right. What shall we do to pass the time?
I don't really know. I suppose we could talk.
It might be better if we didn't. Someone passing by in the hall might hear us.
So?
Well, just because we know there's nothing improper going on, that doesn't mean everyone else would know, too.
Rebecca was very close to him now. She laid a hand on his chest.
Maybe we should do something else.
Rebecca, I thought we had settled this. There can't be anything romantic between us.
Rebecca shook her head as she looped her left arm around his neck.
I'm not talking about romance. I'm just talking about a pleasurable way to pass the time.
But I can't!
Of course you can.
Rebecca forestalled any further conversation by pressing her lips to his. Rebecca thought for a second Seymour was going to pull away or push her back a step. But for all his high-flown morals, he was human after all, and male to boot, which meant that after stiffening for a second, he began to relax and enjoy what was going on. With her right hand, she slipped the knife from the pocket of her dress. The blade was long enough to reach his heart. All she had to do now was plunge it into his back with all her strength between his ribs and into the organ she could feel slugging against her as she molded her body to his. He would die without a sound because she intended to keep her mouth pressed to his until he was finished. The knife was poised, ready for the kill. Why couldn't she do it? Rebecca had turned the key in the lock without him noticing and then slipped it into the same pocket where the knife was concealed. Now someone was trying to get into the room. As a surprised and guilty-looking Seymour started to turn toward the door, Rebecca stepped back and hid the knife behind her.
Lord, what in heaven's name?
Maggie O'Ryan stumbled into the room, clutching the shoulder she had obviously just used to break the door open. She forgot any pain she was feeling, though, in the surge of anger that reddened her face as she glared at Rebecca.
You! I knew you were up to no good! You trollop!
You have no right to break into my room like that, Miss O'Ryan. Seymour, you're the marshal. Arrest her!
You can arrest me when I'm through with her and with you. That's right, Seymour Standish. I have some things to say to you, too. But first...
Maggie advanced on Rebecca, stalking forward like a cat after its prey.
When I saw you taking Seymour up here, I knew you were still after him. I should have known better than to ever trust him. I certainly didn't trust you.
Maggie, I promise you nothing happened.
For God's sake, Seymour, what sort of fool do you think I am? Your face is red. You're breathing hard.
You startled me.
Maggie leaped forward, throwing a punch like a man, and her fist crashed into Rebecca's jaw. The punch's impact drove Rebecca backward against a dressing table. Seymour didn't have time to wonder what the knife had been doing on the table. He lunged at Maggie as she swung another blow at Rebecca's head. The punch didn't land, not because of Seymour's efforts, but because Rebecca recovered enough of her wits to duck underneath it. The two young women crashed together and then slammed into Seymour. It was like Seymour had been run over by a mauling, clawing, hair-pulling buzzsaw. Rebecca scrambled to her feet first and fled, dashing out the open door. Maggie went after her.
Maggie, stop!
Seymour struggled to his feet and stumbled after the two women. Several people were in the hallway, their attention drawn by the commotion. Among them were Cornelia Standish and the three men who claimed to be dry goods salesmen. Standish grabbed his nephew's arm.
Seymour, what in blazes is going on here?
No time to talk, Uncle Cornelius.
Seymour jerked free and ran along the corridor toward the second floor landing, where Maggie had caught up to Rebecca. Maggie brushed aside Rebecca's blows and grabbed her by the throat, evidently intent on choking the life out of her. Suddenly, Rebecca fell, and since Maggie didn't let go, she went with her. At the top of the stairs, Seymour stared at them, a little surprised that both of them were still alive, praying that neither of the young women was badly hurt. As he started down toward the lobby, Rebecca pushed herself up onto hands and knees and then weaved upright. She seemed stunned and not really sure where she was or what was going on, but something, probably instinct, started her toward the front door of the hotel. She was still trying to get away. The young schoolteacher got up and went after Rebecca. Maggie was unsteady on her feet too, but her anger drove her on. Rebecca ran out of the hotel with Maggie right behind her. Seymour reached the bottom of the stairs and went after them. Seymour made it to the hotel porch in time to see Maggie bringing Rebecca down with an unladylike tackle that sent both of them sprawling in the dust of the street.
Maggie! Rebecca! Stop that!
You mad, staling whore!
You little slut! You
crazy bitch!
Out of instinct, Seymour reached for his gun. He still didn't plan to pistol whip them, but he thought that maybe firing a shot into the air would startle them into settling down. His hand found an empty holster. He realized that the gun must have fallen out when they knocked him down in the hotel room when the fight started. With no weapon, he ran toward them, empty hands outstretched. Seymour didn't know if his pleading ever would have gotten through to them or not. He didn't have a chance to find out, because that was when people began to yell and scream, hoofbeats thundered in the street, and the sudden roar of gunshots filled the air. Matt and Sam didn't pay much attention to the eloquent oratory of Addison or Everett Sloan, Esau Paxton's attorney. Instead, they watched the crowd, alert for any signs of trouble. The cowboys from the Double C and Pax kept their seats, content for the moment, just to glower darkly at each other. When the opening statements were over, Judge Clark looked at Addison.
Very well, Colonel, you may present your case.
Thank you, Your Honor. Our case is quite simple. When the CP Ranch, owned jointly by my client and Esau Paxton, was split up into the Double C and Pax ranches, Mr. Paxton signed away any and all rights in perpetuity to any use whatsoever of the stream that forms part of the boundary line between the aforesaid ranches.
Esau Paxton shot to his feet.
That's a dead blasted lie! That creek is the boundary between the ranches. That means we can both use it.
Sit down, sir! Mr. Sloan, I advise you to keep your client under control.
Sloan was already tugging at Paxton's sleeve, trying to get him to take his seat again.
I'll hear from you in due time, Mr. Paxton, and if you try to jump the gun again, I promise you you'll be sorry you did. Go on, Colonel.
Addison raised the document he held in his hand.
This contract is all the proof of our claim that we need. Your Honor, I enter it into evidence as our first and only exhibit. And when you examine its provisions, you'll see for yourself that Mr. Paxton's land ends at the eastern bank of the stream in question, meaning that the stream itself and all the water therein belong to my client, Mr. Shadrach Colton. Furthermore, Your Honor, you will see Esau Paxton's signature on this contract, signifying his agreement to those very terms.
That's not what I meant. And if that's what it says, that's not what I thought it said. That's not what we agreed it would say beforehand.
The slender, dignified Everett Sloan rose to his feet.
Your Honor, I apologize for my client, but I ask you to understand how upset he is over what has now been revealed as the fraud perpetrated by his former partner.
Fraud? What the hell do you mean by fraud?
Mr. Colton, there will be no profanity in this courtroom unless I'm the one using it, damn it! Fraud's a mighty serious charge, Mr. Sloan. What do you mean by making it?
It's quite simple, Your Honor. My client and Mr. Colton agreed before that contract was drawn up that the water from the creek would be split equally. But then Mr. Colton, or his attorney, changed the terms of the agreement and fooled Mr. Paxton into signing it.
That's a lie! I never did anything of the sort! Hell, I never even read the contract after it was drawn up. I don't reckon Esau did either. We knew what it was supposed to say.
I warned you about the profanity. But I'm going to let it pass for now because I want to hear more about this agreement you made with Mr. Paxton. Was it your intention to share the water from the creek?
Don't answer that, Chad. Your Honor, I submit that any further discussion of anything that was said before this contract was executed is irrelevant and immaterial. Any verbal agreements, and I am not stipulating that such agreements did in fact exist, were superseded by this written, signed contract, which does in fact contain language specifying that it is the sole and binding agreement between Mr. Shadrach Colton and Mr. Esau Paxton concerning the division of property theretofore held by them jointly.
Judge Clark gazed with narrow, steely eyes at Addison.
I have a question for you, Colonel. Did you draw up that contract?
I did not, Your Honor.
Then who did?
Am I allowed to answer, or do I still have to keep my trap shut?
Clark jerked the gavel at him to indicate that he should go ahead.
Old Marcellus Riley drew up the contract. He was my lawyer before the colonel here took over the job.
And where is Mr. Riley now?
In the graveyard over at Marfa.
Mr. Riley passed away last year, Your Honor. That was when I began to represent Mr. Colton.
So you don't know if this fellow Riley changed the terms of the agreement to favor his client and then slipped it past Paxton, is that right?
With all due respect, Your Honor, you're engaging in pure speculation, and as such, it's irrelevant and immaterial to the case at hand. All that matters is what is written here, including the signatures of Mr. Colton and Mr. Paxton. It was Mr. Paxton's responsibility to make certain that the terms of the contract were what he had agreed to before he signed it.
Paxton's face was gray and drawn now. Matt thought he looked like a man who knew he was beaten. It was pretty clear what had happened, Matt figured, even to somebody like him who wasn't educated in the law. Colton's original lawyer had pulled a fast one. The creek belonged to Colton, and Paxton's cows had no right to drink out of it. Whether or not Colton had known all along what his lawyer was up to, Matt couldn't have said. The question now was, what would the judge do about it? Clark leaned back in his chair and didn't even try to quiet down the racket in the town hall this time. Whatever he decided here, one side or the other, was going to explode in outrage. Then suddenly, everyone in the room turned to look at the open windows.
What the hell?
The caterwauling sounded like a couple of panthers going after each other. Or a couple of really angry women, Matt realized, as he stepped out onto the porch with Sam and saw the battle taking place down the street. One of the combatants, he saw to his surprise, was that Eastern girl who had come to Sweet Apple with Seymour's Uncle Cornelius. The other was Maggie O'Ryan, who was going after Rebecca Jimerson with all the hot-blooded ferocity she'd come by honestly with her Irish and Latin heritage. Seymour was trying to break them up, but not having any luck at it. The way he was dancing around, he really didn't have any idea what to do to stop the two young women from fighting.
Yeah, reckon we ought to give Seymour a hand?
Yeah, otherwise those ladies are liable to really hurt each other.
The Blood Brothers had just stepped down from the porch to the street when they heard the hoofbeats. They seemed to be headed straight for the town hall, and Matt recognized the burly, bearded figure in the lead.
Al Cazario!
Seymour recognized Diego Al Cazario from the Bandido Chieftain's previous attack on Sweet Apple, but Al Cazario's identity barely had time to sink in before an even more urgent realization hit Seymour. Maggie and Rebecca were right in the path of the galloping horses. In a matter of seconds, they would be ridden down, crushed under the slashing hooves. He had no gun, so he couldn't even hope to stop the raiders. The way they were charging down the street, he couldn't have turned aside their attack, even if he had been armed. So Seymour did the only thing he could. He lunged at Maggie and Rebecca, who had stopped fighting and were staring at Alcazario's men in shock. Grabbing an arm of each girl, Seymour began trying to hustle them out of the way, half urging them to run, half dragging them. He saw the boardwalk right in front of them, 20 feet away, then 10, then 5. The hoofbeats were deafeningly loud now, as were the shots that rang out. As Seymour shoved Maggie and Rebecca toward safety, one of the horses had struck him as it galloped past. He slammed into the edge of the boardwalk and felt pain shoot through him. Dust clogged his mouth and nose, making it impossible to breathe as he landed in the street. As Seymour rolled over, a huge shape loomed over him. One of the bandits had reined in, and now the man's horse reared up on its hind legs, its steel-shod front hooves pawing at the air and threatening to come down and crush the life out of Seymour. Standish scrambled frantically out of the way as the hooves thudded against the street where he had been a second earlier. Seymour ignored the pain that filled his body. There was no time for it. He pulled himself upright.
Hasta la vista, gringo.
Seymour looked up to see the Mexican raider pointing a gun at his head. Both of Matt Bodine's Colts fairly leaped into his hands. Beside him, Sam pulled his revolver. Behind them, the cowboys from the Double C and PAX began to hurry out of the town hall to see what all the shooting was about. The men reached for their guns, only to remember that they had surrendered their weapons as they went into the hearing. The baskets containing the guns that had been collected were still sitting right there on the boardwalk. The delay required to retrieve the guns was crucial, though. The bandits overran the building while many of the would-be defenders were still unarmed. Horses leaped onto the boardwalk. Men screamed as they went down before the trampling hooves. Glass shattered as a fusillade of shots drove several men back through the front windows, their bodies filled with lead. Diego Al Cazario himself led the charge into the town hall, leaping his horse to the porch and then ducking his head so that the mount could crash on through the doors and into the building. Matt and Sam had gone down in the first few moments of the battle, creased in several places by flying bullets. Neither was seriously hurt, but the press of people kept them from getting up. They were in imminent danger of being crushed by the crowd as the melee spread along the front of the town hall. Both of them were big, strong young men, though, and at last they were able to fight their way back to their feet. Matt had emptied his Colts, but he used them as clubs, swinging them in powerful strokes against the heads of the mounted bandits. Several of the bandidos came crashing down from their saddles. Sam had drawn his Bowie knife and was using it to carve out an open space around him in the middle of the battle. Blood flew through the air and spattered his face as the razor-sharp blade sliced through the flesh of his foes. Maggie O'Ryan found herself on the porch of Mayor Abner Mitchell's general store. She hurt all over from the tumble down the stairs and the damage that Rebecca Jimerson had inflicted on her during their fight. But she couldn't even think about that, because when she picked herself up and turned around after Seymour had practically thrown her and Rebecca onto the porch, She saw one of the bandits about to shoot the man she loved. She didn't waste time screaming Seymour's name. Instead, she snatched up a shovel from the barrel that sat on the porch and held an assortment of farming implements for sale. Maggie flung the tool like a spear, putting all her strength behind the throw. Seymour fell anyway, blood streaming from his scalp.
Seymour!
The bandit leaped from his horse.
Puta madre!
The bandit reached for her, but Maggie sprang back and grabbed another tool from the barrel, this time a pitchfork. The bandit lunged at her again, trying to knock the pitchfork aside with his gun. Maggie rammed the sharp tines into his belly. The mortally wounded bandit fell to the ground. Still terrified and shocked by the knowledge that she had just killed a man, Maggie started to turn away, only to have strong arms wrap around her. A grinning face leered into hers from only inches away.
You're coming with me, Gringa!